Chapter 3. I sank back through the building, returning to the incident room on autopilot, disturbed by the lip-smacking zeal with which Pars hoped to exploit Tessa Klein's death. I wondered how he'd react if a set of my teeth were hand-delivered to him one morning. Maybe he'd brush his own a little more thoroughly that night, but I wouldn't bet on it. Naomi walked in and sat down opposite, making a welcome intrusion into my thoughts.
"What are you doing here?" I said.
"Shouldn't I be asking you that? I just got done talking to the corner house lot."
"How was it?"
"You remember the paranoid guy with the beard? Big fan of yours."
"I can imagine."
"He had no idea Esther had been creeping out to St. Mary's. Says he doesn't even know her that well. One interesting thing, though. Someone else turned up at the corner house looking for her. A couple of days before we did."
"Let me guess."
She nodded. "They only spoke to him through the door, but when I asked for a description, it sounded like a certain former detective inspector."
"Blake," I said. "That's why he never reported his phone missing. He was using it to trace her."
"So either this Esther girl has some dirt on him, or there was something incriminating on that phone."
"Incriminating of what, though?"
"This might sound mad," said Naomi, "but I'm starting to wonder what Kevin Blake was doing on the night the Moore family were murdered." I thought for a second, listening to the rain. Then started moving papers about on the desk, searching for our copy of Blake's book.
"Here."
I held open a page and handed it to her. According to a personal aside in the second chapter, Kevin Blake had been in attendance at a regional police conference on the night that the Moore family were murdered. Naomi read this passage and then turned to the glossy pages at the center, finding a photograph of him in a suit at the event, alongside several other high-ranking officers who were named below.
"Well, at least it's good for something," she said, closing the book.
"I thought you weren't going to read it."
"I guess I got interested." "You're not missing much anyway. Just his version of events padded out over 300 pages.
Naomi sighed.
"If we eliminate any more suspects, you'll have to arrest me for it. Do I get to ask what you're doing at work today?"
"Motivational speech from Pars."
"It worked, I see. Should you really be here, Aidan?"
"Is that a philosophical question?"
"Partly. And I'm worried that Louisa still hasn't turned up."
"I know. Me too."
"I'm worried that you've developed a smoker's cough overnight. Mostly I'm worried that you look happy to see me when I walked in."
"The smoke must have damaged my vision, too," I said,
and Naomi smiled.
"I was happy to see you. I always am. If I've let you think otherwise, then that's a failing on my part."
"The smoke's made your voice sound even more sarcastic than usual."
"My name's Aidan Waits," I said, testing it.
"Sarcastic?"
"My partner's Naomi Black."
"Sarcastic?"
"She's the most promising detective I've ever worked with," I said, catching her eye.
She smiled and held it for a second, then looked at the rain through the window behind me. After another moment, I leaned forward.
"That was sarcastic."
"Watch I don't throw the book at you."
"Anything but that," I said.
We looked at each other.
"I'll talk to James about your transfer tonight."
She dropped the book onto the table.
"You don't think Martin Wick killed the Moors, do you?"
"He told me that he didn't. Right after someone went to the trouble of setting fire to him."
I thought of Wick's fist beating against my chest, black eyes lit with anger, staring out from charred, blackened skin.
"I believed him."
She gave this serious consideration.
"We know Frank Moore couldn't have done it. He was passed out with his wife-to-be. We know Blake couldn't have done it. He was surrounded by half the force at this gala event. Esther would have been a kid at the time."
Naomi caught my eye.
So why is she so obsessed with Wick?
That's what Pars wants me to go and ask her.
Now, she said, checking the time. I nodded, and she got up. Come on, then. You shouldn't drive in your condition. I guess your medal for bravery's in the post?
I nodded. That and a few more things. Chapter 4.
We were a long way outside of hospital visiting hours, but Naomi laid it on thick that they agreed to give us a few minutes. Esther was so thin that it was hard to believe there was a human body beneath the bedsheets. She'd been drinking an electrolyte-infused cordial for rehydration, and the mixture strained her lips red, making her skin seem even paler. Perhaps that was why I thought she looked younger. When we'd first met in the hospital toilets, I'd put her somewhere in her mid-30s, but looking at her now, I revised that down by a decade. Even so, there were marks of the lifestyle on her face. A livid constellation of broken veins around her nose, likewise in her cheeks, and the lines beneath her eyes looked like they'd been cut with a scalpel. Her arms were resting on top of the bed covers, fists clenched like she might still sit up and box the world. It was only as her weary pink eyes moved onto mine that I saw some of the fight had gone out of her. The doctor had explained that she'd had her stomach pumped for sleeping pills, been treated for smoke inhalation. If she'd been carried out of there a couple of minutes later, you'd be visiting her in the morgue, she said. Just don't expect her to be grateful. When we walked in, Esther opened her clenched fists, and I saw that her fingernails were bitten to the quick. I couldn't see any green paint from the graffiti at Blake's home, though, and that struck me as odd. She saw me looking and closed her hands again.
Mind if we sit? I said.
She gave a non-committal shrug. Naomi went one side and I went the other.
How are you feeling this morning?
Your voice, she said, with the same smoked-out baritone as mine.
You're the one who got me out.
I nodded.
You shouldn't have bothered. The way I felt this morning, I'd have probably agreed with you.
What happened? She said.
Her accent was somewhere between the hard Irish I'd heard at the corner house and the softer one I'd heard in the toilet at St. Mary's.
You remember being at Val's hotel?
She nodded.
You overdosed on sleeping pills.
Not that.
It was arson, said Naomi. Petrol bombs through the windows, and whatever you might think of your own life, it's looking like three or four men might have lost theirs.
Because of me?
Because the building was unsafe, I said. The exits were blocked, and there were no functioning smoke alarms. Mainly, though, it's because of whoever did it. And only you can help us find them. I'm Detective Sergeant Waits, and this is Detective Constable Black.
We've met, said Esther.
That's right, you let us into the corner house, gave us the phone.
I didn't want to drag them into my shit. Thanks for getting us evicted, though.
After last night, I'd say we were even. You could at least tell me what your name is.
Already told you, she said. Jazz.
Not Esther, Naomi suggested. The woman shrugged and Naomi pushed it. That name was given to us by a man named Christopher Back, although you might know him as Shortback and Sides. She grunted.
In my opinion, his barber should take the blade a bit closer than that. You're not a fan? He makes my shit itch.
And yet you got in touch with him?
Did I?
You seem to connect everyone in this case, said Naomi. You met with Martin Wick, you sold his picture to Charlie Sloan, you got Shortback and Sides to verify it, and you stole Kevin Blake's phone to take it. Now, for whatever reason, someone's trying to keep you quiet. I picked up Esther's electrolytes and took a sip.
We know you broke into Kevin Blake's home a couple of weeks ago. He's the man who wrote the book on Martin Wick. The man who put him away. We know you stole the files relating to the case from him.
Using that information, you contacted Charlie Sloan at the Mail and told him you could get a picture of Wick on his deathbed. Why was that?
Got $5,000 out of the fat fuck.
I shook my head.
I think for some reason you wanted the whole world looking at Martin Wick.
She didn't say anything, but I thought I'd hit a nerve.
Okay, I continued. You disguised yourself with facial tattoos and hung around the hospital, trying to get close to him. You got the picture Sloan wanted, but you kept on going back for some reason. Why?
She still didn't say anything.
You were here on the night of the murder. You saw an armed guard get his throat cut and two men go up in flames. You fled the scene and then torched the car you stole. Hid out in the corner house. We traced Blake's phone there, and you were moved along to Val's, where someone burned down the building to try and keep you quiet. Quiet about what, Esther?
All this talk of petrol bombs, she said. Fire and burning. Christ, I'd kill for a smoke.
We think you bribed an armed police officer named Louisa Yankovsky, said Naomi. I watched Esther closely, but she didn't move. We think you possibly bribed a constable named Michael Rennick as well. Esther's eyes drifted to Naomi when she mentioned Rennick. I thought it looked like she hadn't recognized the name, and that surprised me. If he wasn't accepting bribes, then how had someone got close enough to shake his hand? To stab him?
I think you were in some kind of relationship with Martin Wick, I said.
Her eyes cut to me.
We found your deathbed selfies with him, and we're working through his Strange Ways correspondence now. We'll find the link, Esther.
She smiled, showing us graying, broken teeth.
Martin was my sugar daddy, she said.
How did you meet?
No comment.
Maybe you could tell us what you've got against Kevin Blake then, said Naomi.
No comment.
Are you annoyed with him for locking Loverboy up? I asked.
Esther looked me full in the face.
Yeah, actually I am.
But there's something else, isn't there? What is it between you and Blake?
A brick wall wouldn't be thick enough, she said.
He never reported your break-in, you know. We found out about it by chance. He'd pretended he'd forgotten about it. Said the phone didn't mean anything to him. Only problem is, your friends at the corner house say he turned up there looking for it. Looking for you. That all implies some personal connection. A grudge that goes both ways.
And speaking of grudges, said Naomi, Louisa Yankovsky's scared to death that you'll discuss her complicity in this case, whatever that complicity might be. She's so scared that she went missing with a loaded gun yesterday.
Not someone you want to cross, I said, speaking mostly for myself. The way I see it, you must have something nasty on her and Blake to get them so worked up. Tell us what it is, and you might be saving your life.
I'd be a fucking idiot to save my life, said Esther. Kevin Blake, this Louisa, whatever, you two...
She looked between Naomi and me.
What have you all got in common?
The lore.
We're not on the same side, so don't pretend.
Okay, let's talk about your side. Martin Wick. Did you see the man who murdered him?
She held her mouth tight. Then her eyes moved to mine and she shook her head.
I just stuck the camera out the toilet door. I didn't dare look.
She rubbed her face.
No one dares look.
What don't we dare look at? Asked Naomi.
Ancient history.
Esther was covering her face now, crying.
You're trying to make a jigsaw with half the picture.
So what's the other half? The Moors?
The saintly fucking Moors.
What have they got to do with Martin's murder?
Martin didn't kill them,
she said fiercely.
That's one thing.
I nodded. He told me the same thing.
He told you?
his last words before he died. This meant a lot to him, Esther.
"You've talked to the fridge yet?" she said.
"The fridge?"
"That's what Martin called her. His ex-wife."
"We know it was a man who killed him. We saw your video." She shook her head.
"She didn't kill him. But she's who you should be looking at, if you want to know who did."
"You're talking about Mrs. Wick?" A nasty smile came to Esther's face, and she slumped down in the bed, closing her eyes.
"Have a root around in that fridge. If you can find something moldy, come and talk to me."
Chapter 5 Martin Wick's ex-wife worked at UBET, a licensed bookmaker in Salford, just off the A6. The homeless men sheltering under the awning didn't make it seem lucky, but that hadn't discouraged a slew of last-minute customers queuing to get their final bets in. It was almost 10, and I recognized the energy in the room, the last roll of the dice, the one that might send the day in either direction. Naomi had called ahead while I drove, dialing the number we'd found saved in Kevin Blake's phone the previous day. Susan confirmed broadly what Blake had told us. She'd been married to Wick for less than 12 months, over 12 years ago. They'd been separated before the Moore family were murdered, and she insisted that they had no contact since. She couldn't understand why we'd want to speak to her now, and I heard Naomi struggling to provide a convincing answer. The truth was that we were no different from the men and women queuing to put their cash down on something, anything. Sure things, locks, long odds, or million-to-one shots. We were desperate. We waited while the queue died down, and the chances went, one by one, back out into the rain. Susan knew the police when she saw them. Her eyes cut to and from us, until the last customer left the building. Then she opened the booth that she sat secured inside, walked past us, and locked the front door. As she did, a man appeared at the glass, banging both hands on it, looking from her to his watch in disbelief. She just shook her head and rejoined us.
"There's always one," said Naomi.
"Damn sight more than one," Susan returned, making no secret of looking us both over. In her job she had to be observant, and I could see how that trait might spill over into real life. She had sharp eyes, sharp fingernails, and smelt faintly of smoke. After my experience with it the previous night, it made me feel sick. She took a cigarette and held it, unlit, between her fingers, indicating that we should keep it short. "Thanks for seeing us, Susan." "Suze," she said. "I've had nothing to do with Martin since he did what he did. Since before that, even." It seemed like her voice, face, and personality had all been dried out by smoke, and it made my own throat ache in sympathy. Naomi did most of the talking.
"News of his death must have stirred things up a bit."
"He killed 3 kids," said Suze, matter-of-factly. "I'm not holding a torch. If I had been, I'd have set fire to him before anyone got the chance."
"There was no love lost between you, then?"
"No love full stop, darling."
"If you'd heard asking where I was, nothing like that. 'Cause I was here until late, then with me mother."
"We know a man killed Martin. He was witnessed at the scene. If it's true that you had no contact in the last 12 years, then we've got no reason to suspect you."
"Not a word since he signed the divorce papers."
"You must have needed a magnifying glass for his signature."
Suze nodded. "Had to help him do it. Martin didn't really go to school. If you don't think I did it, then why are you here?"
"How did the two of you meet?" said Naomi.
"He worked in a loft conversion, at the shop I used to own. I had big dreams I'd live above it." She laughed to herself. "As you can see, they all came true. My first real partner, Al, helped set it up. Lovely man. But he died in a car crash."
She said this slowly, as if handling something of great value. "I'm sorry to hear that," said Naomi.
"So a year later, it was nice to get asked out on a date.
I can't say we ever clicked, to be honest. Martin and me. He was the roving type. I was the homebody.
But you married, said Naomi.
I got pregnant.
Sue saw the question in her face.
We never had kids in the end. I miscarried. But by then we were almost walking up the aisle anyway. I knew it was the wrong decision while I was making it.
I know the feeling, I said.
So I talked myself into the big day. I thought marriage might be a comfort after losing Al, losing the baby. I found out I was on a real losing streak, though.
But you married again, I said, glancing at a wedding ring.
She shook her head.
Most of the old boys who come here are drinking in the Last Chance Saloon, or looking for someone to pull up a stool and waste what's left of their lives. It's easier to wear a ring.
She hesitated.
I could never have remarried after Martin.
You shouldn't feel guilty for what he did, I said.
Guilt?
She barked out one joyless ha.
That's one of your modern reasons. Mine's much more old-fashioned. By the time Martin left me, I was damaged goods.
I don't understand.
I couldn't have children, she said.
Was this because of the miscarriage? Naomi asked gently.
Suze fell silent, looking at the unlit cigarette between her fingers. Like I said, Martin was the roving type, but sometimes he did bring things home with him. In my case, a dose of chlamydia. I developed PID and then scarring of the fallopian tubes.
Her eyes went to the glass door behind me.
Like I said, I was on a losing streak.
I glanced over my shoulder and saw that she was looking at her own reflection, wondering when the streak might come to an end.
Chapter 6
Something mouldy, said Naomi, referring to Esther's description of Wick's ex-wife. We'd gone next door to a dark but welcoming pub, where we shared 2 pints and a bowl of peanuts. I nodded.
Sensitively put, but she's shoved us in the right direction. Sue's can't have kids because of untreated chlamydia, contracted about 12 years ago.
At the same time that Frank and Maggie's marriage was falling apart because of a sexually transmitted infection, said Naomi. How does Esther know all this stuff?
We know from the photos on the phone that she spoke to Wick at least once before he died. And there's the suggestion of a pre-existing relationship before that.
And I guess there's whatever she stole from Blake's house, too, said Naomi, looking at me. So come on, say it.
Say what?
Say you think the Moors and the Wicks are connected.
The timelines match up. Suppose Martin Wick and Margaret were having an affair. It provides a link no one ever knew about. It could even suggest a motive for the original killing.
Which is?
Wick blames Margaret Moore for infecting him, for ruining his marriage. He kills her and the kids.
Or, said Naomi, Frank Moore finds out Margaret's being unfaithful, he kills her and then the kids in a fit of rage, framing the man she was cheating on him with.
The problem with Frank is that he has an alibi for the night his family were murdered.
There are more problems than that, said Naomi. What about Wick's Lizzie obsession? Where would that fit into him having an affair with her mother?
Maybe that was all cooked up by the cops at the time.
Naomi shook her head. There were witnesses who saw him skulking around Lizzie's school, hanging round the house, watching her.
He could have gone to those places hoping to see the mother.
They found Lizzie's clothes in his room. And you're forgetting about short back and sides.
What about him?
His big problem with Wick was that he fetishized pictures of Lizzie Moore in prison. He said he'd cut them out of the newspaper.
I nodded, reluctantly.
It had been one of the few times that Shortback had spoken convincingly about anything. Adam had even gone so far as showing me the pictures that he'd found in Wick's possessions.
So what if Lizzie and Martin were having an affair? I said.
Lizzie was a kid, Aidan.
Stranger things have happened. Look at Wick's thing with Esther. Even from behind bars, he had her wrapped around his little finger, The age difference there is pretty eye-watering too.
So you're saying Martin Wick has an affair with Lizzie and gives her an STI? I nodded. But wait a minute. How would Frank contract chlamydia from his own daughter?
I didn't say anything and saw the possibility cross Naomi's mind.
What's wrong with you? She said.
The jury's out, but it certainly gives Frank a secret worth killing for.
Agreed.
And however it went down, we've got a possible link between the two families that no one seemed to know about before.
But what do we do with it? Margaret's like the elephant in the room with Frank. The STI thing only came out because he was shaken from seeing the witness statements.
The elephant in the room, I said.
I took out my phone and dialed the number I had for Charlie Sloan.
I'm boarding a train, he said, picking up. And I've got my heart set on the quiet carriage. Glad to hear it, Charlie. But I need a favour. Tell it to the dial tone. You know, we could still have you arrested.
He didn't say anything.
Or you could leak a story for us.
The printed word's something I happen to live and die for. Whatever you might think of me, I'm not interested in being someone's mouthpiece.
Don't worry. The printed word isn't fast enough. This needs to go out sooner.
Like a tweet, he said, after a slight pause.
Come on, then. What's the story, Morning Glory? The detective inspector who survived the attack at St. Mary's Hospital has made incredible strides towards recovery. He's been brought around from his induced coma, and we'll be speaking to him about the attack tomorrow morning.
Ah, he said. What time tomorrow?
Very first thing.
Consider it done. But this makes us even.
Sure, I said, ringing off.
The barman was calling last orders, and Naomi was frowning at me.
Sutty's not awake.
I want to know who'll pay him a visit if they think he is. In the meantime, I need you to get over to Strangeways. Get hold of Frank Moore's records, employment, counselling sessions, attendees, everything.
Now?
It's a prison. You'd hope someone's awake.
What about you?
I drained my glass.
You were right. I forgot about short back and sides.
Chapter 7
What? Said Axel, staring at me through the chain on the door. I hadn't brought my lockpick set with me this time, and had to wait in the rain until a little old lady let me into the building. I was still breathing heavily from 10 flights of stairs.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but I want to talk to Shortback.
He's not in, he said, pushing the door shut. I had my foot in the way, and he looked up at me.
We've got a new coffee table. If you need to, get your regression out there.
I waited.
He's hosting at the Carlisle.
Hosting what? I said.
The karaoke. Does it every Thursday night?
That's... Axel raised an eyebrow.
Not what I expected.
People can surprise you, he said. Anything else?
Don't expect him to be back any time soon.
The Carlisle was the condemned-looking pub on the corner, with a burned-out car in front. It looked like some daring, charred sculpture left there by an art school graduate. The bar was almost empty, just a few stragglers hanging on for last orders. The sound system was banging out an instrumental version of Young at Heart, and Shortback was on stage, delivering a passable Sinatra. Vocally, at least. The stage lights were being switched on, detailing the crater in his skull. The difference between the way he looked and the way he sounded, between what he was and what he wanted to be, felt like the excavation of a sad universal truth, and I decided to let him finish singing. I went to the bar, keeping my eyes on the stage, and ordered a large Jameson's. Shortback was so lost in the music, so blinded by the lights, that he didn't see me. And by the time the song soared towards its conclusion, his voice breaking with emotion, I'd already drowned the whiskey. I turned into the bar as he stepped off the stage, and he came alongside me to order a drink. I put my hand out to shake his, cuffing him as soon as I saw his wrist.
"The fuck?" he said, eyes flashing pure mania.
I was probably giving him the same look.
"Let's have a drink,"
I said.
"Take this fucking shit off me."
I dragged his arm towards mine by the cuff.
"I said, let's have a drink. The ladies must love you."
I ordered us two large whiskies and turned to him.
"You said Martin Wick was obsessed with Lizzie Moore."
"Yeah," he said, uncertainly.
"That blonde girl he killed."
"And you found pictures of her in his cell?" He nodded, looking wary, but still disturbed by it. I recalled what he'd said about the dent in his skull coming courtesy of his stepdad and tried to take it down a notch. I remembered the envelope that Adam had given to me from my jacket pocket and held it open, showing him the clippings.
"Were these the ones you saw, Chris?"
He looked at the clippings and then away from them, revolted.
"Yeah."
I waited for his eyes to come back to me and then started to unlock the handcuffs.
"Talk to me,"
I said.
Part 7. Violent Past. Chapter 1.
Naomi and I were sitting in Sutty's hospital room, with the lights switched off, listening to the steady beep of the heart monitor. It was the dead of night, and we'd each taken a seat either side of the door. If you were looking in, you wouldn't be able to see us. Sutty's few visitors had known not to bring flowers, and I'd cracked open one of the bottles of Johnny Walker that had been left at his bedside. When I took a glug and offered it to Naomi, she gave me an instinctive look of reproach, then shrugged, accepted the bottle and took a drink.
"Christ," she said, holding it back. "No one liked him enough to buy a mixer."
"I could probably find you some liquid soap. Just tell me what you think's coming through that door."
"I honestly don't know. It might be the cleaner. It might be a petrol bomb."
"At least then we could see what we're doing."
"It might even be nothing at all," I said.
We both fell silent at the footsteps sounding along the corridor. I thought I could hear two distinct sets, and I held my breath as they drew to a stop outside. The person or persons paused, perhaps looking through the small glass pane into the darkened room. There was a low murmur as two voices conferred with each other. Then the door opened, and they stepped inside. One of the figures, a large man, approached Sutty's bed, the curtain drawn around it, and I flicked on the lamp beside me. Frank Moore stopped with his back to us. He turned, looking from me to Naomi, then to his wife, Rebecca, still standing in the open doorway. He drew himself up to his full 6 feet and 4 inches, finding a smile for us.
"I always said you were in the dark, Waits."
"Frank," I nodded. "Rebecca, why don't you join us?" Moore turned towards the two empty chairs either side of Sutty's bed and went smoothly to the nearest one. He sat bolt upright, with remembered military posture. Rebecca followed, a little less sure of herself, moving first to her husband and then to the free seat on the other side of the bed. Frank moved the curtain, squinting through the gap for a second.
"He doesn't look awake to me."
"They said that before the coma," I said, settling the bottle down on the floor.
"What brings you here?"
Frank brushed his hand through the lightning bolt shock of white hair in his head.
"We read that Sutcliffe had been brought round. I was hoping he might take over the case."
"Frank," said Rebecca, "there's no need to take this man seriously," he said at the side of his mouth.
"We came to offer support," said Rebecca, arranging the flowers in her hand.
"Frank won't admit it, but he feels responsible."
"That's a first," I said.
"We've got a butchered family, a murdered prisoner, a police officer fallen in the line of duty, another one still fighting for his life, and absolutely no one willing to take responsibility."
"Martin Wick," said Frank, levelly. "He takes responsibility, whether the bastard wanted it or not. As for the rest, that's your job, Waits.
The world won't come to you. But what if Martin Wick wasn't responsible? Frank's head weaved like a punch-drunk boxer, and he gripped his knees to steady himself.
He wrote a very detailed confession, he said.
Maybe you should read it.
That's probably more than he managed. What are you talking about?
Martin Wick was functionally illiterate, Frank. We spoke to his ex-wife today. They broke up a few months before your family were murdered. She had to help him sign his own divorce papers.
How do you think he did with a 25-page confession?
Well, blood doesn't lie. Sometimes.
It does.
What's that supposed to mean?
He said it like he was starting a fight in a bar, and Rebecca went on explaining their presence, as if the intervening argument hadn't happened.
We came here to visit a man who was hurt guarding Martin Wick, she said. We came here because we have experience with trauma and we can help. You're acting like we climbed in the bloody window.
You did sign in, I take it. What do you think? She shot back, sounding suddenly like a husband. Constable Black, could you confirm that for us? Naomi got up and left the room while we waited in silence. Frank was so tall that he loomed even from a seated position, and I thought again how enormous he must have looked to a frightened wife and three scared children. Naomi returned with the sign-in sheet, handing it to me and resuming her seat. Both Frank and Rebecca had signed in, clearly stating their names, contact details, and time of arrival. They'd even given their reason for the visit, to offer gratis counselling support to Detective Inspector Sutcliffe and his family. I looked up, saw Frank's head cast low, Rebecca clutching her flowers. The heat was rushing to my cheeks, the back of my neck burning red.
I'm sorry, I said, dropping the pretense. As you can probably tell, Detective Inspector Sutcliffe isn't awake.
What was all this?
Said Rebecca, a jolt of that same strength I'd seen that last time we'd questioned her husband's good name.
Because I think the media might be interested to hear about it. Charlie Sloane's had your number right from the start.
Rebecca, said Frank, trying to think.
It's the truth, she went on, pointing at her husband. Here you have a man as much a victim of Martin Wick as the people he killed, and all you can see is...
Rebecca, said Frank, more forcefully this time. She looked at him, but his eyes were on me.
Tell me again, Waits, about this confession.
It might be nothing, I said, but it's the truth. He couldn't read or write. When he signed it, he was at least in shock, maybe worse. He didn't have a friend in the world, and as soon as he could, he tried to retract it. The look of concern that had been growing on Frank's face was now threatening to overwhelm it. He looked like a man who'd had something of great value delivered to the wrong address. I was certain, suddenly, that he hadn't killed his family, certain he'd had nothing to do with it. He'd never doubted Wick's guilt until now. There's another crime here, though, Frank, and I have to ask. Did you have anything to do with Martin Wick's murder? He held eye contact with me and shook his head. I looked at Naomi and she stood.
Why don't we put those in some water, she said,
gesturing to the flowers they'd brought. Rebecca got up and opened the toilet door. She let out a startled cry as Shortback and Sides emerged, wearing a Sinatra-inspired fedora.
All right, Frank, he called across the bed.
The look on Moore's face hardened, moving from incomprehension to suppressed rage. He held out an arm to his wife and she joined him on the far side of the bed. Then he stood, giving her the chair while he leaned massively into the wall, arms crossed. I could see the muscles beneath his blazer, tensed, testing the sleeves to breaking point.
I believe you've met Mr. Sides, I said.
What's going on? Said Rebecca. Who is this man?
Shortback emerged fully into the room and took his hat off, revealing the dent in his skull. Smiling, he showed us the golden grill covering his teeth. Alongside the neck tattoo, the chemically assisted thousand-yard stare, he looked like a patient who'd made a break for it.
Mr. Moore was my counsellor in strange ways, he said.
What kind of counselling did he give you? I asked. Shortback sucked noisily on his grill.
All kinds. He focused on Rebecca, the only person in the room he hadn't met.
You might not have noticed, but I have. Like a slight physical defect I sometimes get self-conscious about. Mr. Moore helped me see I was a thing of beauty, whatever the weather.
You also killed a man, I reminded him.
By accident, yeah. That's why I was there. Mr. Moore said I should forgive myself, like.
How did the two of you get along? I asked.
He was good to me, said Shortback, with what sounded like some real emotion. Not many have been.
Frank nodded. Glad to be of service, Chris. You were good to me too.
Yeah, said Shortback. You were especially good to me when you found out I was Martin Wick's cellmate. Even more once you heard what I was in for.
Frank shrugged without looking at anyone in particular, flexing the muscles in his arms as if to remind us they were still there.
I don't recall saying anything like that.
Constable Black, I said. Naomi collected some papers at her feet. I've just come from Strange Ways, she said. One thing the governor gets right is his paperwork. We pulled the records of every inmate who'd attended one of your survival sessions while inside. Could you confirm these names for us?
She stood, handing him the sheet. Moore had reddened, and I could see him trying to think his way around whatever was coming, but he glanced at the sheet and nodded.
Looks about right. No Martin Wick on there, as I said.
No, said Naomi, glancing at Shortback.
Chris is on here, though.
So he should be, Frank answered with a smile.
Look, I could go down this list and tell you every man on it. I worked with them all, but
sorry, said Naomi. I think I've given you the wrong list.
She handed him another sheet.
This is the list of men you've worked with at Strange Ways. That first one is a list of all the men who attacked Martin Wick while he was inside.
Frank looked at the two almost identical lists and smiled, eyes drifting to the door. I got up and stood in his way.
How did you manage it, Frank?
I don't know what you're talking about.
In that case, maybe Shortback can enlighten us. He told us what Martin had done to his family, he said. Told us what Martin had done to his kids. Told us Martin stalked his daughter before killing her. That he was a nonce.
What about the pictures? I asked.
Oh, yeah. He said Wick kept posting him newspaper clippings from prison. Pictures of his little girl.
Lizzie Moore, I said, looking at Frank.
Yeah. Mental. Like a fucking serial killer or something. Mr. Moore asked me if I'd, like, search our cell on the lowdown. Said I might find some. So I did. And I did. After that, he had me convinced.
I don't understand, said Rebecca.
Frank put a hand on her shoulder, but she shrugged him off. Frank was using his position at Strange Ways, I said. He manipulated men with life sentences into attacking Martin Wick while he was inside. What he's holding there is a smartly chosen list of inmates. He targeted violent criminals. Didn't you, Frank? He didn't say anything. Men who'd gone down for 20, 30 years. To them, a few more months for assault was worth it, especially with Wick being so loathed. Some of them he paid. Some of them he just manipulated. It'd be easy to defend if Martin Wick really killed his family. But now he's wondering, what if he was an innocent man?
Come on, said Frank, turning rigidly to his wife. We're leaving.
Don't forget to sign out, I said, waving the sheet in front of him. He frowned, looking at it in my hand. I made a show of studying his writing.
Now, where have I seen that before?
I dug out the envelope that Adam had given to me, holding it against the sheet.
Mrs. Moore, can I trouble you for one more thing? Is this your husband's handwriting?
She tried to get up and fell back into a seat, then stood abruptly, not looking at Frank, coming clumsily towards me. She covered her mouth when she saw the envelope. It was addressed to Martin Wick in her husband's handwriting.
What's inside? She asked.
Come on, Rebecca, let's...
What's inside? She repeated.
I held open the envelope. Her hand went from her mouth to her chest,
like she couldn't breathe.
You,
she said, turning to her husband.
You were sending that animal pictures of your dead daughter, your little girl.
Frank tried turning a wince into a smile, but it wouldn't go. He could lie to me quite happily. But he nodded at his wife, sinking into a seat with his head in his hands, looking revolted with himself. I held the door open for Shortback. He swept his hat back on and left the room with a level of discretion I wouldn't have thought him capable of. Even he could sense the shame in the air.
Chapter 2.
The door opened suddenly, and we all turned. I'd been expecting to see Shortback, returning for some reason, but it was former Detective Inspector Kevin Blake. Once he saw me, he couldn't leave, and he stepped into the center of the room, letting the door fall shut. He was even paler than the last time we'd seen him. Under the harsh hospital lighting, his skin looked a sickly neon white. He stared at the curtain surrounding Sutty's bed, but didn't say anything. The room was silent, apart from the steady beep of the heart monitor. If it had been hooked up to me, it might have been going a bit faster. Evening, Kev. Nice of you to drop in. He started with the obvious. Doesn't look like he's awake. Same old Sutty, I said. But you're right. We've all been had. Naomi and I saw the news ourselves and came running. Looks like you had the same thought. What's going on? Said Blake, more to the room than to me. His antennae were still finely tuned, and he turned, trying to get a clear read on us. Frank looked away, standing, offering Rebecca his chair, resuming his looming position against the wall. He folded his arms tightly across his chest, like he was trying to force shut an open wound. Frank's been enjoying his time at Strangeways so much he's going to start sleeping over, I said. You what? You tried to tell us, Kev, but I wasn't listening. What did I try and tell you? You tried to put us on Frank's trail. Frank's expression didn't change, but I heard the material in his sleeves flex as he gripped his arms a little tighter. I wouldn't say that exactly. His name just came up. But we'd never have made it to his survival seminar without your tip. What did you want us to see? A man who'd pulled himself together. Or a charlatan dishing out platitudes for cash. Now hang on, said Blake. But as he looked around the room, he saw that not even the Moors were prepared to defend Frank's work now. Every single time we talked, I said, you kept banging on about Frank's charity work, the poor conditions at Strangeways. You even brought up the subject of Shortback and Sides, like you were trying to put us onto the trail. You're giving me too much credit here, pal. Put you onto the trail of what? Frank's work at Strangeways, I said. He was working at Strangeways. News to me.
We pulled his employment records today, said Naomi. You're a reference.
Blake shrugged.
I can hardly help who puts me down as a reference.
Before we could push him on this, there was a knock at the door. I opened it to Charlie Sloane. He was out of breath, moving his head from side to side, trying to look over my shoulders.
This a private party, or can anyone join?
The more the merrier, I said, standing to one side.
I thought you were on a train out of town.
I was, until you told me your man was up and at it again.
Sloane sidled inside, clapping his hands together.
Said anything yet?
I closed the door behind him. Don't believe everything you read in the mail, Charlie. I'm afraid he's still under.
We've had a steady stream of well-wishers, though. I take it that's why you're here.
Sure, said Sloane, taking my seat,
ripping a handful of grapes from the bunch he'd brought with him.
We were just discussing the revelation that Frank's been visiting Strangeways every week for the last 5 or 6 years.
His eyes took in the room, the drama, and he laughed.
No wonder poor Martin couldn't eat a meal that hadn't been spat in.
I nodded. Apparently that only occurred to you and me, though. Blake says he had no idea that Frank Moore was a violent man.
Did he not?
Said Sloane, chewing more grapes and looking at the former detective inspector.
I could hear the burgeoning journalistic interest in his voice.
That was a surprise to me too, since you showed him the witness statements from Frank's neighbours 12 years ago.
Witness statements? Said Rebecca.
Witness statements of what?
Sloane spoke with a handful of mashed grapes.
Your husband was getting to know his first wife's face like the back of his hand.
Rebecca looked at the floor with a kind of quiet dignity, I thought.
I never saw any statements, said Blake. Sloane didn't tell me shit 12 years ago.
Sloane glared at him.
You weren't interested 12 years ago.
He definitely got interested again this week, I said.
That's why he made sure we saw them.
Did I? Blake clapped his hands together.
Did I really?
You vandalized your own home when I sent a squad car around to take a statement.
My arse!
Then you just happened to mention that you were supposed to be meeting Sloane.
I suppose I broke into me house, stole me own phone as well.
No. That's you trying to change the subject. We've arrested the person who stole your phone. Don't worry about that. Blake was trapped between two topics he didn't want to discuss, and he reverted to the previous one.
Why would I sit on stories about Frank's violence for 12 years?
Charlie, I said. You told us the witness statements didn't run at the time.
We deal in heroes and villains. Blake had already provided the villain.
Simple as that, I said. Making Frank out to be the bad guy 12 years ago wouldn't fit the narrative. When I glanced over, Frank Moore was staring right through me. With a man of his height and physicality, you don't read the expression on his face, but his body language. Emotions seemed to pass through him from head to toe, and he was in a state of continual, agitated motion now. Arms folded, loosened, refolded, like he was trying to holster his fists. Blake swiped the air.
If I'd known about those statements...
We're always hearing about what you would have done, Kev.
Everyone looked at me.
You would have looked at Frank differently if you'd seen the statements. You would have looked for other suspects if Wick hadn't been covered in blood. You would have reported his abuse in prison if you'd known Frank was working there. You'd have reported your phone missing if you hadn't forgotten. We're supposed to believe that all these omissions suiting your story are a series of happy accidents.
I'm a long fucking way from happy, he shouted, clutching his chest. What are you trying to tell me? That Frank did it?
I thought he looked afraid of the answer. Frank rose up to full height and walked slowly across the room. He leaned into the wall right in front of Kevin Blake, staring right at him. His every move carried the threat of physical violence now. Let's talk about the mobile that was stolen from your house.
This again!
This again and again. Until we hear something that sounds like the truth.
Why didn't you report it missing?
I didn't get around to it.
I shook my head, looked at him.
Either you didn't want the police to find what was on that phone, or you didn't want the police to find the person who'd taken it.
Blake trembled.
Why would I be worried about some fucking junkie?
Maybe she told you something you didn't want to hear.
Like what?
Something that threw the last 12 years in a different light. Something that you had scrambled to shit into a desk fan and fire it at Frank Moore.
Excuse me, said Rebecca.
Like what? Shouted Blake.
Excuse me, said Rebecca, standing.
We were all on our feet now, except Charlie Sloane, who was still eating grapes, watching the drama unfold with amused interest. Rebecca was looking at the heart monitor, which had been steadily beeping faster as our conversation had grown more heated.
I think we need to get someone for him.
I wouldn't worry about it, I said. Everyone in the room looked at me. Detective Inspector Sutcliffe's not here. We moved him to another room 2 hours ago.
Chapter 3. I drew back the curtain and the figure in the bed sat up, peeling away bandages. Once exposed, Esther looked about the room, even more flushed than usual, sweating and sharp-eyed. She started moving the bedsheets we'd used to fill out her figure, ripping off layers of clothes and finally pulling off the pads connecting to the heart monitor. It flatlined, into one long, unbroken beep. "Did you break into this man's house?" I asked. She stared at Kevin Blake and nodded.
"Who is this woman?" said Rebecca.
Charlie Sloane chuckled. "She's an intimate of Martin Wick's. I've seen the pictures to prove it."
"Then what's she doing here?"
"The two of them corresponded while Wick was in prison," I said. "They even managed to meet a few times while he was under armed guard. You might say she's our window into his soul."
"Well," said Rebecca, folding her arms, "some of us would rather not look."
"Esther, can you tell us when you first met Kevin Blake?"
"At his house," she said, watching Blake twist under Frank's glare. "A few weeks ago.
You told him about the campaign of violence against Martin Wick. You must have told him who was behind it too, because afterwards he went out looking for dirt on Frank Moore."
"He wouldn't help me though."
"How did you want him to help you?"
"I've had enough of this," said Blake, craning his neck to look up at Moore. He looked weak, sick, wrong, weaving on his feet. "I can only apologize for this display, Frank. And you," he stabbed a wild finger in my direction, "you should be ashamed of yourself."
"There's the door, Kev." He started forward, but Frank shoved him back into a chair. Esther was gripping the bedsheets, trying to keep from shaking.
"Once I knew he wasn't interested in the truth," she said, "I thought, fuck him. I went in a back window one night and took everything on Wick I could find, as well as a phone. We're sitting there, passcode attached, why not?"
"And how did you use that information?"
"He had files on where Wick was, what personnel were assigned, all that. He was clearly still friends with the cops, even if he wasn't one anymore. One of the other things I got was his number," she said, nodding at Sloane. "Conned a few grand out of the fat fuck who wrote all those stories about Martin."
A flash of anger crossed Sloane's face.
"You wouldn't have if I'd known who you were, missy," I nodded.
"She'd probably have got a bit more for that."
"What's that mean?"
I waved him quiet.
"Why did you take the picture, Esther?"
"You were right. I wanted the whole world looking at Martin. We wanted to make dickheads out of them all."
"Mission accomplished," said Naomi, smiling, encouraging. "What did you do with the cash?"
"Some to pay off Shortback, some to pay off that woman cop.
Louisa Yankovsky?"
"Yeah, some foreign name. I paid her to let me know when Martin was alone, to give me a few minutes with him."
"Sorry," said Sloane, waving everyone quiet. "You said I'd have paid more to talk to her if I knew who she was. Shit or get off the pot."
Esther looked about the room.
"Men," she said. "You've got sex on the brain. Me and Martin, intimate. He was my dad, dickhead."
Frank turned from Blake, squinting.
"Martin Wick didn't have kids," he said.
One by one, they all turned to look at me. "You knew Martin Wick was sleeping with Margaret when you got together, Frank. You must have known there was a chance that Lizzie wasn't yours."
Chapter 4 Frank Moore walked to the wall and punched it as hard as he could. The whole room seemed to shake, and he turned unsteadily, slamming the heart monitor to the floor. It had been droning in one unbroken beep since Esther had removed the sensors, but he kicked it now, stomping repeatedly until it was just wreckage. He stood there, in the center of the room, fists clenched. When we confronted Frank with the witness statement suggesting he was an abuser, he told us the truth for a change, that he and Margaret fought because she gave him chlamydia. So it was interesting when Wick's ex-wife told us that Martin had infected her with the same thing, at around the same time.